So I want tonight to continue talking about insight, which is, after all, our reason for being here and doing this. And I wanted to try to offer just a little bit of an introduction to a teaching that I was studying and giving a series of talks on last month when I was at the Forest Refuge. So in its long form, this was 5 Dharma talks. I'm going to try to give you guys the executive summary tonight. I'll see how it goes. But so this is very much a make what you will of it Dharma talk. So this is a teaching that brings together a lot of different strands of the Dharma. For those of you that are old yogis, have heard a lot of teachings, especially with us, many of these strands will be familiar and will make sense. For those of you that are here on your first retreat, not so familiar with the Dharma, there might be a lot in it that you don't catch this time around, and that's totally okay. So this is definitely one, you know, if you can catch a couple of things from it that seem pertinent to your practice, then that's enough. And the rest of the time, you can just continue to follow the rising and falling of your abdomen. So this is a teaching that comes from a text called The Path of Purification, the Visuddhimagga, which is a commentary on the Buddha's teachings written about 1,000 years after the time of the Buddha. In Sri Lanka, one of the main teaching monasteries there by a scholar monk called Buddhaghosa. And it's kind of an important text to at least have heard of if you're going to be practicing in the Mahasi style, because it very much provides kind of the textual basis for this practice. It's more of a meditation manual. And in fact, Mahasi's Manual of Insight that we mentioned is kind of a commentary on this commentary. So if you look at the original teachings of the Buddha, the early Buddhist teachings from the Pali Canon, the Buddha doesn't actually give a whole lot of meditation instructions. You know, he gives a lot of teachings like about impermanence, about the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, but he doesn't offer a lot of actual nuts and bolts instruction, a little bit here and there. So this commentary was an attempt to kind of pull, you know, what could be gleaned from the Pali Canon as far as how to actually practice. So it's very useful, and this is what Mahasi and other innovators in this style in the 19th, 20th centuries pulled their inspiration from, pulled their instructions from. So I want to mention this one teaching that Buddhaghosa describes. It's called the three functions of insight, the three functions of insight, or the three aspects of insight. And just briefly, these are knowing, the function of knowing, observing, the function of observing, and abandoning, the function of abandoning. So knowing, observing, and abandoning, according to Buddhaghosa, the three functions of insight, the three jobs, the three tasks that insight accomplishes through in the course of our meditation. So to start with the first function of knowing, this is a very specific kind of knowing, which is what we've been talking about so far at this retreat. It's knowing what's actually happening now. This is the first function of insight, is that it allows us to know what's actually happening now. So coming into direct contact with experience, coming into direct contact with what we're actually sensing and experience in this moment, which is what is actually happening right now. That's all that's actually happening right now. So what's really happening apart from all of our concepts, all of our ideas, that whole conceptual overlay, all the stories we have about what's happening, right? This is just what we've been talking about so far all the time on this retreat. Knowing what's actually happening in the present moment directly, not through the medium of concept, not through the medium of interpretation. And in the Buddha's teachings, in the suttas, he offers a number of different schemes for doing this, all aimed at kind of deconstructing what's going on. Because it's a bit of a mouthful to just sit down, you know, and give the instruction, okay, just be mindful of everything that's actually happening right now, right? I mean, we're moving in that direction. That's the direction that the practice moves in. But when we first sit down to feel our bodies and become aware of our minds, that's just too big of a task. None of us can start there. Even the Buddha couldn't start there. So we need to take it in manageable bite-sized chunks, right? That's like why we break it all down into, you know, different sensations in the body. Maybe we just look at the breath. We just look at the steps. So we start with manageable bite-sized pieces, and then we kind of expand it gradually as our meditation chops improve, as our skills improve. So the Buddha offered a number of different approaches to breaking it down, how to kind of carve up experience into manageable chunks. And the instructions that Buddha Gosa gives, he takes the combination of what's called the teaching on the six sense bases, which I think we've already mentioned, so the five physical senses plus the mind, considered as a sense base also, and then breaks the mind down further into the four mental aggregates. So those are there's a teaching of the five aggregates, which is the body, plus four different aspects of the mind. So if you take the physical aspects of the six sense bases, the five physical senses, and you take the mental aspects of the aggregates, the four components of mental activity, then you can blend them together to get kind of a schema for how we can carve up as a first pass what's going on in the body and the mind. And I'll post a list of this on the board for those of you that might be interested. So there's this general approach of dividing up physical experience and mental experience, what we call rupa and nama, or usually it's called nama and rupa. Usually nama comes first. It flows a little better. Nama rupa, rather than rupa nama. You know, it's like when you have a couple and you have to decide whose name comes first. So nama won out in this case. You may have noticed, you know, as we pay attention, that the body, the realm of physical experience, is kind of its own sphere, really, or its own five spheres. You know, that there's the realm of tactile sensation, and that is different from the realm of, say, thought and mental activity. They happen in different realms, not different physical locations, but they're just on different planes, right? So we don't feel physical sensations in the mind, and we don't think in the body. You know, the body has its particular sphere of things that it takes in, that it experiences. The mind has its particular thing, set of things that it takes in and experiences. And they're each their own separate realm, so to speak. So that's what nama rupa is. It's the whole set of all of the physical phenomena, all the physical experiences that we can sense, and all of the mental experiences that we can sense. And at first glance, both of these may seem very complicated. There's all sorts of different things that we experience. And when we're only used to experiencing them through the medium of concept, through all of our stories and interpretations about them, they can seem, you know, just innumerable, the different kinds of physical experiences we can have, the different kinds of mental experiences we can have. But when we look at it through this framework of nama and rupa, it becomes much simpler. And when we use that framework to sit and look at our experience, then it also becomes much simpler. So with physical experience, which we've really very much been emphasizing these first days of the retreat, or the first little over half of the retreat now, we might be starting to see, if we look carefully, if we look continuously, how it really is just made up of these relatively few building blocks, right? So we've been talking about the elemental physical experiences, the experience of all the manifestations of matter, heaviness, hardness, lightness, softness, all the manifestations of temperature or kinetic energy, scientific lingo, you know, all the different points on the burning hot to freezing cold spectrum and everywhere in between, that sense of temperature and all its different manifestations, and all of the different manifestations of what we might call kinetic energy, what's called poetically the air element, all the different manifestations of movement, from very coarse movements, slow movements, to very light, rapid vibration, tingling. So you might have started to see, at least in moments, that really that's what every experience is composed of. You know, experiences that we call knee pain, or experiences that we call comfort, or, you know, whatever experiences we're having in the body, however we interpret them through concepts, if we look, it basically just comes down to some array, some matrix of those building blocks. Then we have these other sense organs. You know, we have the eyes. They have their own sphere. They just take in light and color. We have the ears. They just take in vibrations, that manifest as pitch, higher or lower, or volume, louder or softer. We have the tongue, which is a little more complicated, but you know, has a certain set of flavors that it takes in. The nose, which is really complex. The nose is a really complicated sense, the most complicated sense. But they each have their own sphere. You know, we don't taste sounds, we don't hear smells, you know, each of those is its own, again, separate sphere that we can tune into. So that's what we can directly sense in the present moment. One of those, something happening at one of those five senses. Those are the senses that we're equipped with. That's rupa. Then there's nama, the realm of mentality, mental phenomena, mental experience. The mind is more subtle and more complex with the body. That's why we start with the body, move gradually to the mind. But still, despite the great variety of the content of the mind that we can have, you know, the possible content of our thoughts is, you know, infinite. Can think anything, and we do, as we get to see. But if we look at the actual functions of mind, you know, the types of activities that it's engaging in, and if we kind of leave the content of all that to the side, we find that, again, it's actually not that broad a range of things. It's a little bit more, a little bit broader than with the body, but still is a manageable number of activities and functions that we can identify. The actual experience that we can sense happening in the moment in the mind. So one of these we spoke about today, we spoke about vedana, the experience of the pleasure-pain spectrum. So this is again one that there's just not a good word for in English, which I find I'm constantly amazed by because it's such a fundamental aspect of our experience, right? This is really what's driving us in life, and we'll speak more about this. But so in any given moment, we might sense the feeling tone or the vedana of it. Do we feel intense pleasure, ecstatic pleasure? Do we feel, you know, agonizing pain? You might think of like 10, and you know, the scale going from 10 on one side to 10 on the other side. And at any given moment, we're somewhere in there. And how we're experiencing that is very much driving the choices that we make, what we decide to do. There's the experience of perception, which is a really interesting one. It's that automatic recognizing of what is being experienced. So in the visual field, I find it easiest to pick up on this. So for example, if we look up here at this thing, this clump of brown shapes with darker and lighter patches on it, we don't have to generate the fully formed thought. That is a statue of the Buddha in order to know what it is, right? We don't have to look around the room. When I look at this green blob over here, I don't have to think, that is a plant, in order to know what it is, right? Those are fully formed thoughts. The function of perception is much more fundamental than that. It's much more basic. I look at it, I see that shape, those colors, those patterns, and I immediately recognize it. It happens on a pre-verbal level. I might then have the thought, oh, what a lovely plant. I wish I could have one like that in my house and not kill it. But that's a thought. The perceptive faculty is much, much more basic, pre-verbal, fundamental, instantaneous, and immediate. There's the mental function of consciousness itself, which we might notice at times, just the simple fact that there is awareness, you know, that we are different from this blob of matter here. You know, this looks like a human being, but there's no consciousness, right? We're made out of the same basic atoms and matter, but there's consciousness here. There's the knowing, there's the presence, awareness. And then there's a few other things. There's thoughts, which we're all familiar with. This is often the first aspect of mental experience that really comes into view. We can notice that we're thinking. There's emotions. Everything that we think of here in the West is emotion. And then a number of mental factors that we don't really think of as emotion, things like concentration or mindfulness, attention, that aren't really emotion in the sense that we think of here in the West, but they're qualities of mind, functions of mind. And then a few other things, which we'll talk about more. So there's still this fairly limited set of things that we can know, that we can sense going on in the mind. A thought may have any sort of kind of content, but one thought is really like the next, or the next, in the sense that it's a thought. It has a certain way that it functions. It has a certain way that it manifests in the mind. It has a certain way that it feels in the mind. And we can tune into that. So the function of knowing, this first function of insight, is to tune into all of that, which is what we're doing here through this practice, and especially through this particular technique of Mahasi-style meditation. But whatever style of meditation we practice, whether it's a different type of Buddhist meditation or modern mindfulness meditation or in an entirely different meditative tradition altogether, if we're working towards insight, that meditation is going to have to accomplish this function. It's one of the basic functions of insight. We've got to get into contact with what's actually happening, with what's really happening. We have to find a way to step out of the stories, step out of those mind-generated worlds, and get in touch with what's actually being sensed and experienced in the present moment, with what's actual reality. So as we've mentioned before, this is the only place we can actually see what's going on a deeper level with reality. This is the only place we can learn about reality, is that we're actually in contact with reality. If we're thinking about reality, we can only learn conceptual things about reality. We can only come up with more ideas about reality. We have to actually be in contact with our direct experience of the moment if we're going to be able to learn anything about it. I mean, it's really only logical, right? So the Mahasi method, this particular style of meditation, is very much, as you might be picking up on, optimized to kickstart this function of insight. You know, the techniques that it uses, the approach that it uses, have been optimized to get this function of insight going really as quickly as possible, you know, without dilly-dallying around with other stuff. So the instructions all keep pointing us back to what's the actual experience of the moment, what can we actually feel, what's happening in the body, what's happening in the mind, underneath our concepts and ideas about what's happening. So if we think about the Mahasi tools, you know, using a primary object, having that home base that we come back to over and over again so that we can really hone in on the flow of specific sensations there. Using the noting, you know, to get the mind used to connecting with the sensations over and over again with clarity, kind of dropping the concepts as much as possible, even though the noting itself is a concept, getting as close as we can with the concept that we're noting so that we can really point towards the actual experience. And then going through this whole exercise that we've been putting you through of trying to describe then to a teacher the flow of Nama Rupa, right? We don't want to hear what you think about how your practice is going. We don't want to hear about how strong you think your concentration is or what it means about your psychological conditioning, you know, or your early life. We're just focused on getting in touch with that flow of Nama Rupa, the flow of mental and physical phenomena. Just that. That's the whole focus, to get this function going. It's not that those other things aren't important, but it's just not what we're doing here. We don't want to waste time. Don't want to dilly-dally around with all that. We don't have that much time. So it's not trivial to tease out the various elements of Nama Rupa and see them separately. It's a big change in perspective, right? You know, we're asking the mind to look at things. We're asking mindfulness to look at things in a very different way than we're used to, and which runs counter, really, to all of the conditioning we have of how to think about our lives and how to relate to our experience. So it's a big ask. It's a big ask of mindfulness to do this for us. We're totally conditioned to live in the world of concepts, to live in the world of thought constructs. Those of you that have been on retreat with us before have probably heard my ramen noodle analogy, which is how I talk about teasing out the different strands of Nama and Rupa these days. So if you've ever made instant noodles, like cup of noodles, or you can get these like blocks of ramen noodles that come in a package and like a brick, you know, and you can look at them and you can see there's a whole bunch of noodles in there, right? But when you first get them and they're all stuck together and congealed like that, you can't pull out an individual noodle. They're all stuck together. If you try to pull one out, the whole thing just crumbles. You have to add the magic ingredient of boiling water, you know, and let it sit, and let it stew, and let it percolate, you know, until everything softens up. And, you know, and then when it's ripe, when it's ready, then you could reach in and pull out just one noodle and look at it and say, okay, there's that noodle. So this is my very elegant metaphor for pulling out the different strands of nama rupa. When we first sit down and we look at what's going on in the body and the mind, it's all stuck together, you know, with our conceptual overlay of what's going on. We have to add in the magic ingredient, the broth of mindfulness, you know, so that it can soften and loosen up and, you know, ripen until it's ready. And then we can reach in and pull out, okay, there is, you know, hearing. Pull out the hearing strand, and it's clear. There it is. That's that strand of hearing. Or here's the strand of that thought. You know, there's that one thought. You can see it just as it is, separate from everything else. So this is one of the reasons that we need more than just mindfulness to do this practice. You know, it's not just a question of mindfulness. There's actually the special seasoning blend that has to go in with the hot water. So it takes more than just mindfulness to soften up the strands of nama rupa. All of these other supportive qualities that we talk about, qualities like the Brahma Viharas, kindness. It takes a lot of kindness for things to soften up. It takes a lot of compassion. It takes a lot of appreciation and gratitude, a lot of equanimity. The other spiritual faculties, it takes just the right balance of energy and concentration, faith and wisdom. It takes the various, what we call the awakening factors, interest, joy, tranquility, all the paramis, generosity, integrity, renunciation, patience, honesty, and resolve, not to mention a good sense of humor. It takes all of these supportive qualities in order for that magic broth to do its work and loosen up all the strands of experience so that we can actually get in touch moment by moment with the nama and rupa of the experience. Somebody once asked Sayadaw Upandita, when I was in a question and answer session with him, why is it so hard to see nama rupa? Because it does sound relatively straightforward when you hear these kinds of teachings or when you see a list like the one I'm going to post on the board. It's like, okay, here's this, you know, relatively limited set of things, and the instruction is just to sit down and become aware of them. And I found Sayadaw Upandita's response interesting because the response that you usually got in interviews was, well, just try harder or just keep going. But he responded to this question differently, and this is my paraphrase of what he said, but he basically said human beings are complicated, that there's a lot more going on with us. It's not so straightforward. So the teachings, and especially these kind of classical, traditional teachings, are presented in a very analytical, structured, straightforward way. But he said that's for academic purposes. That's for teaching purposes. That's so that we can kind of wrap our heads around them and remember them and, you know, all that kind of thing. Have a frame for them. But then when we sit down on the cushion to actually practice, it's a different matter. It's much messier. So we need all of these supportive qualities to help us along, to get the mind into the right relationship to experience where it can actually touch into what's going on. So the instruction that Buddhaghosa gives us in the Visuddhimagga in relationship to tuning into nama and rupa is to stay with what's clear. And this is something that we say a lot of different ways in a lot of different contexts to you. Stay with what's clear. You know, so we might hear these teachings. Maybe we hear the teaching about Vedana and it sounds like, oh yeah, that's a really good idea to see that. I'd really like to see that. And then we go looking for it. And we can't really find it. Or maybe we think we found it and then we end up thinking about it. Or we end up straining and trying to find it. So the instruction is to stay with what's clear. It's by staying with what's clear and letting that ripen that the things that aren't clear will come into view. So we really don't need to push or strain. When the time is right, things will reveal themselves little bit, light by little. So this is the first function or aspect of insight, the function of knowing. Knowing what is actually happening, the first function of insight. I have another metaphor I'm going to offer you in relationship to these three functions is that it's a little bit like a trip on the space shuttle, which doesn't run anymore, unfortunately. But so this first function of insight is it's like the launching of the space shuttle or the launching of the rocket. I guess it could be any rocket. So, you know, we've all seen the images, the TV reporting, you know, the news of the space shuttle or another rocket ship taking off, and the launching is very dramatic, right? It's always a very nerve-wracking, you know, experience watching a launch of a rocket. Is it going to make it? Is it going to blow up? You know, or what's going to happen? Is it going to actually be able to get off the ground? You know, and then they do the countdown, and everybody's waiting, and then there's this huge explosion, right? Like, and everything, all the fuel tanks explode, and there's all this smoke and fire, and you know, the scaffolding is falling away, right? So, like the first couple of days of a retreat, when it's like, oh my gosh, the sleepiness and the hindrances and the wandering mind and the agitation, you know, is this ever going to get off the ground? You know. Because there's you know, just as the rocket ship is trying to break free of the gravity of the Earth, we've got to break free of that gravitational pull of being in our conceptual stories about the world, right? That's where we're used to living. That's where our gravitational pull is into that world of concept, into that world of story. So we're like, it's a big effort to break free of that, to pull away from that. You know, it takes just the right balance of all the supportive qualities, you know, it takes a big effort initially to launch the practice and to get it going. But then eventually, you know, we get past that initial break free of the earth, and there's still a lot of, like, you know, fire and explosions, you know, the fuel burning off, keeping, lifting us, but little by little it gets smoother, you know, as we get up and away from the earth, and eventually we're on our way. So when we get to a place where we can see all of those strands of ramen noodles separately, and we can see clearly what's arising and passing in the mind and body, then this is when insight can arise. So we just start seeing this passing parade, moment after moment of, you know, now a bit of body, now a bit of mind, now another bit of mind, then something else in the body, something else in the body. And you start to see this parade, this flow, this stream of moments of this and moments of that, nama and rupa passing by. And at some point, we're able to really get this. You know, after we've watched, you know, 532,698,742,311,621 moments of nama and rupa going by, it starts to dawn on us. You know, there's a critical mass of data. It's like, oh, this is actually all that's going on. You know, we've been watching, you know, the body and the mind, the flow of nama and rupa for however many, you know, 5 days now here about. Some of us, you know, for weeks or months or years or decades, retreat after retreat and during our practice at home. And at some point, it becomes convincing. The body of evidence becomes convincing. This is all that's going on. We have yet to see anything else in our experience that is not some manifestation of mind and body. But that's not an intellectual understanding, right? I mean, we can have that thought very easily. Oh, yeah, that's all that's happening is mind and body. That doesn't accomplish anything. We have to actually do the work. We have to actually gather the data. We have to actually take it in, you know, moment after moment after moment until the heart is convinced. You know, this mysterious way of learning that we call insight happens on a completely different level from intellectual understanding. It's learning with the heart. It's learning at a deep level, an intuitive level. So at some point we get this, that there is just nothing else, that nama rupa is all that's going on. And not just now in this moment, but in every moment. The mind makes that inferential leap that, you know, I've seen however many trillions, billions, millions, thousands, hundreds of moments, and they've all been like this. This is how everything is. There is nothing else out there. It's all nama rupa. And most of the time when we're getting this insight, we don't actually realize it because we're not seeing anything in particular. We're just seeing one moment after another of physical and mental phenomena. No one of them in and of themselves is particularly remarkable, but they build up, and little by little, the heart gets it. And at some point, you know, this is the way insight tends to manifest, is that it's happening, and we don't really realize it. It's happening behind the scenes, below the surface. But at some moment, there's an aha experience where the insight kind of bubbles up and hits the brain. It's the thinking brain, and the thinking brain goes, oh, right, there's just nama rupa. So that's when we tend to become aware of it. But that, if just because we're not having that realization intellectually, doesn't mean that it's not happening. Early on, when I heard these teachings about nama rupa, I was really mystified by them, as I was with pretty much everything when I initially heard it. A lot of this doesn't just make intuitive sense. As like, what do you mean? Everything is nama rupa. I mean, like, I've got, you know, here I am, and there you are, and I've got my life, and, you know, my home, and my friends, and my family. What do you mean everything is nama rupa? And when I did finally start to see it, I didn't realize it. I had to have it pointed out to me. And I was interviewing at this point with one of Sayadaw Upandita's assistants, a wonderful monk called Sayadaw Usasana. So I'd come in, you know, day after day, as we do, and tell him about my breath, and tell him about my step, you know, one day, 2 days, 3 days, a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, however long it was, until one day I came in, and he asked me through the translator, what is your mother? I looked at the translator, I was like, come again? Because for, you know, however many weeks it had just been, tell me about your breath, tell me about your step, tell me about general activities or a secondary object. That was the routine. So I looked at him, the translator said, Sayadaw says, what is your mother? I'm like, okay, well, what is my mother? You know, so I reflected for a moment, and I just dropped into, you know, the mind and the body, what I was experiencing there, and I reflected, what is my mother? And in that moment, I could see there was a thought about my mother. There was a mental image that came to mind. There were some emotions that arose, which generated feelings in the body. And I got it. And I said to him, nama rupa. And I laughed out loud, because it just seemed so absurd. It was just so obvious. This, all she is in this moment is just a stream of mental and physical phenomena. You know, the idea that she's something other than that is just an idea. It's just another thought arising in this moment. There is nothing else. It's just nama rupa. And then Sayadaw laughed. And we both laughed. It was like the biggest joke in the world. It's all nama rupa. And he asked me a few more things like that. You know, I think he asked me, like, what's your father? And I said, nama rupa. And we laughed. A few more things like that. And then he rang the bell and dismissed me. But I hadn't realized until he pointed out to me, when he could see that I was ripe, that I was really getting that insight. So getting this really changes our perspective on what's going on. The more that we come to understand that all that's happening is nama rupa, not as an idea, but actually experiencing it directly, you know, it weakens the force of craving and aversion in the heart, the clinging of the heart. The heart becomes less inclined to get caught up in struggling and reacting to particular experiences because they're all just nama rupa, you know. On the conceptual level, there may be very compelling reasons why we feel craving or aversion around our mothers, but it's a lot harder to get worked up about a stream of physical and mental phenomena once we realize that that's all that's really going on. So this is the first function of insight, knowing what's really happening. The second function of insight is what's called observing. Well, observing what? Observing the three characteristics that Tara spoke about last night. Observing the universal qualities of experience. The impermanent, unsatisfying, impersonal nature of experience. So the first function of insight, the knowing, knows what's really happening in that stream of nama rupa, knows what's happening in the flow of mental and physical phenomena as they really are, with all of their particular qualities, what we call their specific characteristics. You know, is it heavy? Is it light? Is it hot? Is it cold? Is it red? Is it blue? Is it still or is it moving? Whatever the particular quality of the experiences. So the first function of insight picks up on those, all of those details, details about what's actually happening. The second function of insight, the function of observing, picks up on the trends, on the bigger picture, on the universal qualities of all of those experiences, regardless of what their particular qualities might be. So a moment of really intensely pleasant experience and a moment of really intensely painful experience to that first function of insight look very different. They have very different particular qualities or characteristics. But to the second function of insight, the function of observing, they're the same. They're impermanent. They're unsatisfying, and they're out of our control. So it's different ways of looking at the same experience. So we could think of it as the first function of knowing sees the trees, and the second function of observing sees the forest, sees the big picture. So when this observing function of insight is dominant, then there's no longer that clear sense of connecting in a very distinct way with the particular experiences, the particular objects of body and mind, whether it's our primary object that we've chosen or secondary objects. Because the mindfulness is more focused on, we could say it's focused on the moment itself rather than the content of the moment. It's seeing the quality of the moment, which is that it's always changing and it doesn't leave anything behind and it's out of control. So there starts to be this sense of really just resting in flow or resting in awareness itself. And that kind of observing, that second function of insight, it's not something that we need to make happen. And it's not actually something that we can make happen as much as we would like to. This process would be a lot easier if we could make it happen. The first function is the one that we can work on. And the second function kicks in when the first one is ripe, when the mind is ready. But at that point, then, we can just really settle back and let the Dharma do the observing on its own. All we really need to do at this point, when this function is strong, is really just get out of the way and not create problems. So the tools that we used initially to jumpstart that first function of knowing are no longer so necessary. We might need them a little bit here and there just to stay on track, but we can greatly reduce or at times completely let go of the noting. We don't need to stay so close to the primary objects, maybe just now and then when it feels like they're helpful. So we can think of this function of insight as when the space shuttle's gotten into orbit. You know, it's gotten to its cruising altitude. It's gotten to wherever it's going to go around the Earth in its orbit. And there's not really much to do in terms of keeping it on track. It's in a stable orbit and it's just going. You know, and if the astronauts look out the window, then they can look down and see the big picture of the blue marble down below. They're getting the big picture view. And they can go off and do their experiments or whatever they have to do, and they don't have to pay so much attention to keeping the vehicle on track. And as with the knowing function, this function is also mostly happening without us realizing it. Just moment after moment, again, in any given moment, what we're seeing is not particularly dramatic or noteworthy, but we're just noticing moment after moment, things disappearing, you know, things not leaving any residue behind, you know, not having any ability to control their arising or their passing. We're just kind of taking it in moment by moment without realizing it most of the time. But still, again, getting it on that intuitive level, the heart is getting it. And there may be occasionally moments when that insight bubbles up to the thinking mind and the light bulb goes off and there's a moment when the mind, the thinking mind, articulates it. Oh, everything is impermanent. You know, so that's when it tends to hit us, when we have that light bulb moment. One of my favorite Sayadaw Upandita quotes says, "Every moment of mindfulness brings the yogi one moment closer to full enlightenment, whether they like it or not." So, you know, we're always so hungry for reassurance. You know, is it really working? Which is natural. Am I really doing it right? Is it really okay? Is my practice really on track? You know, which is why it's great to have a good spiritual friend that we can check in with, who can reassure us, yes, it's okay, it's really happening. It is a leap of faith, you know, and so the longer that we go on the path and we see how this happens over and over again, you know, how insight is growing, and occasionally we get a glimpse into that, but not always, the more we can trust the process and just let it do its thing. When we're in a place in our practice where the observing function is strong, and mindfulness and concentration have some momentum, and effort has come into balance, and not too much, not too little, just the mama bear level of effort, then we might at times get what we call dharma goodies. The dharma goodies. So these are the bells and whistles of practice. These are side effects of our practice that can be interesting, that can be insightful, but they can also be seductive and somewhat confusing at times if they're unfamiliar to us. Some of the more common ones that might arise are what we might call psychedelic effects. Some of you might have had some of these. Sometimes we get light shows, laser light shows going, like at the rave, you know. Or maybe we're bathed in white light, like having a near-death experience, you know, bathed in white golden light. Or there can be odd things that happen to the body, sense of distortion of the body, like we might feel like our right arm is like 50 feet long, or we might feel like we weigh 2,000 pounds, you know, we just absolutely can't move, we're so heavy. We might feel like we're flying on a magic carpet, even though we know that we're sitting still. We might feel like we're kind of hovering 3 feet off the ground. So these and many, many other odd experiences of the body can happen. Pretty much you name it, we've heard it. This just comes from the ordinary sense of perception of the body falling away as we get more in contact with the truth of the specific and the universal characteristics, the flow in nama rupa. Our ordinary way of interpreting experience loosens up and can fall away to a large extent. So that conceptual overlay really recedes. And it turns out without the conceptual overlay, things start to feel very different. So there is a lot of insight in that experience. We're really getting that, you know, what we think of as the body is not this nice, neat, anatomical package that we tend to conceptualize it as. It's this vast field of amorphous experience, you know, filled with vibrations and trembling and light and all sorts of things that doesn't look anything like what we think of as the body. We can get experiences that we call rapture, which is not actually always so rapturous, but it can be kind of chills and thrills, you know, waves of vibration going through the body. Sometimes it can be jolts. Very interesting, compelling experiences in the body that may be ecstatic, or at times it may feel like we've stuck our finger into an electrical socket. We can have experiences of what we call bliss, which is a feeling of just, you know, profound, sweet, content, happiness. It tends to be one of people's favorite. So just this pervasive, deep sense of happiness and comfort in body and mind. Like we just can't even imagine being more comfortable than we are. We can get a sense of deep tranquility. This sometimes happens where we sit down, you know, we get settled, we start our meditation. It seems like just moments later the bell rings. Like our sense of time has just flown by, because we've just been so calm, so tranquil, we feel like we could sit for hours. You know, we might have a thought like, why was this so difficult? I can do this all day. What was the problem before? Why did this seem so hard? We can have the sense of effortless effort. You know, all those struggles with, you know, trying not to work too hard, trying not to fall asleep, trying to get just that sweet spot of effort can fall away, and we are in a place where it just feels like the practice is doing itself. It's effortless. We don't even need to do anything. We can have an experience of equanimity, where the things that usually trigger us just don't get a rise out of us. We're just so chill. So maybe that obsessive thought, you know, that's been just driving us crazy arises again, and the mind's kind of like, eh, no big deal. Don't need to grab that one. You know, or we encounter something, you know, in the meal line that would normally excite us a whole lot, one way or the other. And the mind again is just kind of like, eh, not a big deal. Don't really care. So these are just a sampling of the Dharma goodies that are available. And they serve a few useful purposes, these kinds of altered consciousness experiences. For one thing, they're usually nice. They're usually pleasant. And pleasure is a great support on the path. You know, there's a lot of unpleasant. There's a lot of struggle on the path. So when we do fall into a place that's pleasant, it's rejuvenating. It's energizing. It helps us to relax and rest and recover from all the difficult times. So it keeps us energized and engaged. And it is also a sign that things are moving along. It's a sign that that conceptual overlay is loosening up. The ramen noodles are melting, are releasing, and that, you know, things are coming along. Buddha Gosa has a cute spot in the text where he says, basically in so many words, slackers don't get Dharma goodies. It's not his exact words, but that's basically what he says. So, I mean, it is a sign that our concentration is growing, our mindfulness is gaining momentum, we found a good balance of energy, so it can be very validating, very affirming, can give us some hope. So that's also really useful. The Dharma goodies also change our perspective on ordinary goodies. They change our perspectives on the sense pleasures that we're normally chasing after in our ordinary lives. Some of these are just way better than anything we're going to encounter in our ordinary lives. You know, it's like a good meal at our favorite restaurant really can't hold a candle to spiritual bliss. So it kind of reframes our, like it changes the yardstick by which we're measuring things, you know. After a good bout of tranquility, like, you know, the next episode of whatever show we're binging on Netflix doesn't have quite the same allure, you know. We just judge things differently. It doesn't mean that we're going to stop wanting sense pleasures or stop enjoying them, but just like the framework, the context for them changes. And the Dharma goodies also open our eyes to the nature of happiness, because they're totally internally generated. They're not sense-based. So mostly what's happening when we get some of these Dharma goodies is that we're just sitting quietly, or maybe we're pacing back and forth, you know, or maybe we're having a meal or something like that, or having a shower, but nothing extraordinary. That sense of delight, that sense of pleasure isn't coming from contact with something external. It's coming from the quality of the heart and mind itself. So this can arouse greater faith in the potential of our practice. It can expand our ideas about what's possible for us. When we first encounter one of these altered states that we haven't before, it's a big wake-up call. It's like, oh, I didn't know that was on the menu. You know, like that's something totally unexpected. So what else might be possible? Other things that we didn't think were possible for us might also be on the menu. So we can grow in faith. So the second function of insight operates very much like the first one, this function of observing. So again, at some point, as Tara described last night, there's a critical mass of evidence, right? We've observed 500 trillion, 300 billion, 400 million, you know, 700,000, 382 moments, and none of them has lasted. And none of them has satisfied us. Even the most pleasant ones haven't left us with any feeling that we now don't need another pleasant moment. None of them has left us with any lasting satisfaction. And we have had little to no control over any of them, right? So at some point there's a critical mass of data, and we get it, that everything is impermanent, unsatisfying, impersonal, out of control. And the heart lets go more, little by little. We run a little less frantically around the wheel of samsara, chasing after things that we know can't last, things that we know can't satisfy, things that we know we can't really control. So we have a little more faith that there has to be another way, a little more of an inkling that there must be another way, that if we're going to find real peace and happiness, it has to be somewhere else rather than in all of this experience, which clearly doesn't deliver. This is a poem that Buddhaghosa includes in the Visuddhimagga in this section. It's called Upon the Tip of a Needle. Life, personality, pleasure, and pain all arise and pass together in a single fleeting moment. Even celestial beings who live for thousands of eons are not the same for 2 moments together. The moment that ends when we die, and those that end while we live, all are the same, gone forever. The moment that's vanishing now, and those that will vanish later, all are the same as those that have vanished before, gone forever. There's no way to save the passing moments, no way to store them for the future. A living being stands like a mustard seed, balanced upon the tip of a needle. Fleeting moments come and go, from and to nowhere. We only glimpse them as they're passing by, like flashes of lightning in the sky. That image of the mustard seed balanced on the tip of a needle, like, always gets me. Always hits me in the heart. You know, it's like just so poignant and so true. You know, we've really seen this recently, how much this captures our situation as living beings, even just in a relative sense. You know, we've really seen these last years how it's all so vulnerable. It's all so fragile. You know, our own lives, the lives of those that we love, our communities, our society, our species, our planet, you know, it can all just go in the flash of an eye. And we see this in the absolute sense, too, through our practice. You know, that moment of pleasure, that moment of pain, that wisp of thought, you know, that flash of warmth. It's all just going in the flash of an eye. I actually use this image when I do compassion practice, mustard seed perched on a needle. It just so much captures the ephemerality of the situation. I mean, if we look around, or if we don't look around, but we sense around, you know, each one of us is a mustard seed perched on the tip of a needle. And when we really start to take that in, that's one of the things that we see through insight, just how ephemeral, how vulnerable all of it is. And in the face of that, what reaction makes any sense but compassion? It's the only response that makes any sense. Okay, lickety-split through the third function, which is called abandoning. Third function is called abandoning. So it turns out that it's not actually enough just to see the specific and universal characteristics, which are the first two functions of insight. There's another ingredient, there's another function that has to happen, and that is that we need to come to terms with it. So that doesn't automatically happen. This is something that we don't always talk about. You know, there's this process of coming into contact with what's actually happening right now, seeing the three characteristics in it, seeing the universal characteristics of it. But then once we've seen that, we have to actually digest that. We have to take that in. We have to come to terms with that. We have to accept that this is how it is and let go of the illusions, the delusion, the ignorance that we've been holding on to. So that's why this function is called abandoning. It's the aspect of insight that lets go of our former misunderstandings, our former illusions and delusions about what was really happening, all of our incorrect ideas and perceptions about what was really going on, which we've been hanging on to for a long, long time. We've been really invested in our view of the world, our understanding of life. At times, when we come up against the truth of how things are, the universal characteristics, the ephemerality of existence, there can be a great sense of relief, right? Some of us have experienced that. It's like, oh, thank goodness, it's not all my fault. You know, suffering is not a personal failing. You know, this is just the way that things are. So it can feel like a huge load is lifted at times. It can be a great relief. We might even feel euphoric. Great sense of joy when we discover this. But the more that it sinks in, that this really how it is how it is, and that it's not just something we can dabble in, this is something we have to face, that can be a bitter pill to swallow. You know, we need time to mourn for our lost illusions, our lost fantasies, those cherished stories that we've been nursing and nurturing for so many years. we have to come to terms with just how deluded and ignorant that we've been, and that we're just never going to get the kind of satisfaction out of life that we've been hoping for, that we've been trying for, that we've been striving for so long. There's this kind of irony that we would all like deep transformation. You know, we'd all like to have real change in our hearts and minds that lead to greater peace and happiness, but we'd like it to be painless. we'd like it to be painless change. But if we think about it, it only makes sense that if there's going to be real transformation, if there's going to be deep transformation, that's going to involve also deep loss, deep letting go of what's been holding us back, which, as difficult as it might have been, is also what's familiar and what we know and what we've cherished and loved. So it's not realistic to think that it can happen any other way. This isn't what we tend to imagine when we start out, that there's going to be, along with what we gain through the practice, there's going to have to be a deep letting go of what we're losing through the practice. And this is, again, why we need all of those supportive qualities of love and compassion and patience and equanimity and everything to be able to hold this part of the process. So this function of abandoning, we can think of as the space shuttle or the rocket ship coming back down to Earth. So, you know, we've gone out, we've been in orbit, we've seen the big picture, but then we have to come back, and it's a little bit of a bumpy ride, right? We've got to descend through the various layers of the atmosphere. There may be points at which we're not sure we're going to actually make it safely back, but eventually we glide in, we land back where we were. So we arrive back at the same place, really, that we started, but with a totally different view. Totally different understanding, totally different perspective on what's going on. So these are the three functions of insight that Buddha Gosa talked about. So knowing, observing, and abandoning. Knowing what's actually happening in the present moment, observing the universal qualities of those, and then abandoning our misconceptions, our delusion, and our ignorance. And we move back and forth between these different functions of insight over and over again. They get progressively stronger, they mature, they become more effective, and our insight grows and deepens every pass that we make over these repeatedly. And when all three functions of insight have developed to a certain depth and strength, then there's the possibility that the heart-mind might touch into the one thing, the one aspect of existence that is outside of nama-rupa, the one thing that's not part of our conditioned physical and mental experience, which we call the unconditioned, aka nibbana or nirvana. And once we get a glimpse of that, then things will never be the same again. One of the greatest benefits of practicing with a teacher from the Mahasi Sayadaw lineage, and especially practicing in a center where there's the Mahasi teachings and teachers, and we're surrounded by other practitioners in this tradition, one of the benefits of that is that it's absolutely taken for granted that we all have the potential to realize nirvana. It's just a given. It's like not even questioned. It's just an assumption that this is a perfectly reasonable, rational, attainable aspiration. It's just taken as a given that if you can get yourself to the retreat center, if you can follow the instructions as best you can and just keep going, the transformative insight is a real possibility for all of us. And being surrounded by that kind of faith and confidence in the power of the Dharma and the efficacy of this practice is an incredible support on the path. So we want to give you some transmission of that confidence, because we share that confidence that this is something that we can all aspire to. It's not pie in the sky. So an unskillful application of these teachings on these three functions of insight is to try to use them as a recipe or a map. You know, these aren't step-by-step instructions. So it's not, okay, I'm going to do function one, I'm going to do function two, I'm going to do function three, I'm going to get enlightened. You know? Liberation is not like putting together a piece of IKEA furniture. And we see pretty quickly as we walk this path that it doesn't happen like that. You know, it cycles around. You know, we get in touch with what's really going on a little bit, open a little bit to the deeper qualities of what's going on, take some time to digest that, come back, touch into it at a deeper level, and over again, as these all three of these functions mature and deepen and strengthen. So a skillful application of these teachings, and the reason I felt inspired to offer these, is I feel it gives a useful framework just for holding all of the different things that come up in practice, all of the different twists and turns that our praxis takes as we go along. So, you know, at times we are struggling with the hindrances, you know, we're trying to blast off. It's a hot mess, you know. At times it's like that. That's part of the functions of insight. At times we do get in touch with the actual reality of the moment, you know, all those little bits of physical and mental phenomena flowing by, and we can really see what's happening. At times we fall into that place where we can just rest in the flow of phenomena and take in their ephemeral nature in a deep way. At times we get some of these, you know, wacky experiences in practice, and they may be interesting or unsettling. They may really entrance us for a while. And at times we open to things really in a much deeper and different way than we had before, and we need time to digest that. We need time to take that in and adjust to it. So we go back and forth between these different aspects of practice, these different functions of insight. Even sometimes over the course of just a few breaths, we might hit all three of these. Even over the course of just one in-breath, we might hit all three of these. Or over the course of a retreat, or over the course of a decade. And that's all okay. All of these aspects of the practice are valid and important functions of the path, of what we're doing. They're all part of the Dharma. This is a poem, excerpt of some writing from Ajahn Mun, who is one of the founders of the Thai forest tradition and also considered widely to be an arhant, a fully enlightened being. He didn't do a whole lot of writing. He was really a forest wandering monk, you know, like he had no possessions and didn't settle at a monastery. He just kind of roamed around in the forest. but this was a little bit of his writing that was found when he died. He wrote, "Once there was a person who loved himself and feared suffering. He wanted happiness that was secure and lasting, so he wandered endlessly. Wherever people said that happiness could be found, he tried to get there, but so much wandering took a long, long time. Then one day he discovered the truth and abandoned the cause of suffering and imaginary things. He found a cave of wonders and endless happiness in the body. As he gazed around the marvelous cave, his suffering disappeared and his fears subsided, experiencing limitless peace. This is the path of freedom. It's up to you to go or not. I'm not trying to fool you or force you. I'm just telling you the truth for what it is." Let's just be quiet for a moment.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.